Our speaker is Professor Jenna Johnson Haynes, who's in the Department of Demography and also in the Department of Sociology. And she's going to be speaking on wishing and hoping, fertility intentions in Africa. And I'm not sure exactly how we're... I guess we'll start without the...
We're wishing and hoping. Turn on mirroring.
There it is.
It's contagious?
Yes, the projector illnesses are contagious.
Do you want to talk to someone else who can deal with your computer?
That would be great. So while we're wishing and hoping that the slides will appear, I'm just going to start to talk. So what I'm going to be speaking from today is I'm going to be speaking about a topic that I feel quite passionately about, which is fertility intentions. And I'm going to be speaking from, mostly from, data collected by Ted Miguel, who's here in the economics department, the PI on a fantastic large project with the very in Kenya, where he generously allowed me to add some questions about marriage and fertility intentions and outcomes. So that's what I'm speaking from today. So the paper is joint with Ted Miguel and with a former student of his, Joan Hamery Hicks, and funded by NICHD. For decades now, for a very long time, we have thought primarily about reproductive outcomes as being centrally the consequence of fertility intentions. That is, people formulate in their mind a future plan, particularly a future plan that is oriented to having a specific number of children, and then they try whatever means they need at hand in order to make that intention happen. This vision of the world where people formulate intentions and then enact them has a long philosophical tradition from Hume to Searle. Philosophers who have thought about the relationship between intentions and actions using models of very simple behaviors. And it would be really helpful to have some slides at some point here.
Your machine is locked up.
My machine is locked up. This poor little computer was doing so well until the... Like in the example that developed by Searle here in the philosophy department, where he says that let us take the example of opening a window. If you want to open a window, what you do is you first formulate in your mind a vision of a future state in which that world is completed, in which the window is opened. Then, holding that mental representation in your mind, you stand from your chair, cross the room, reach out your hands, and open the window. But it turns out that reproduction is not very much like opening a window, for a variety of reasons. Don't spend your time thinking about the ways in which childbearing is not like opening a window.
I know one.
But it turns out it's not in a whole variety of ways. Some of these are pretty simple, like you basically always need someone to collaborate with you in the making of children. You don't always need help in collaborating on opening a window. There's a great deal of uncertainty in reproduction, much less so in the opening of windows. But another thing that's very important is that achieving a desired family size takes a really long time. And it's not a very realistic assumption to imagine that people formulate in their minds some fertility intention, and then hold that in mind. You want me to rechange this thing, right?
Yeah.
Hold that thought.
To what?
Go up one. 10, 24, 7, 68.
10, 20, what? The people formulate in their mind a vision of a imagined future that they will someday actualize, and then just go about living their lives holding that mental representation in mind while until it is completed. So we have a conceptual model. Yes, okay, fine. Today. That's what we said.
That's
the one. No lines. Gorgeous. Okay. So we have a conceptual model of fertility that has a long historical, a long philosophical tradition, but in some ways doesn't make very, very much sense. And it is held by extremely smart people and used in all kinds of work. So the fertility decline is a largely rational process driven by the desire for smaller families. Phil Morgan, in a beautiful review, and Phil, an extremely, extremely smart guy, writing, key to explaining the quantum, in this case of births, is intended parity of young women, increased or decreased by a set of model parameters that reflect forces not incorporated in their intentions. And then Lant Pritchett, in that heavy contentious paper that everyone has to have on their orals, high fertility is explained almost completely by high desire for children. So, but reproduction isn't like opening a window, and a lot of people know this. So there's lots and lots of papers. We're not breaking totally new ground here to look at what intentions mean and how they work. Lots of people have recognized that this analogy is a little misplaced and have tried to collect data on intentions and on outcomes, ideally collecting the data on intentions before the outcomes, and then looking to see to what degree there's a match or mismatch. And that tradition goes back to the classic work by Charles Westhoff many, many years ago. And so this is not a radically new thing that we're doing. But we are doing a couple of things that I think are new. We're looking here at not just your intentions at time one and your births between time one and time two, but we're particularly interested in what happens with those intentions themselves. What do they look? What is their character? What kinds of creatures are they, even at time one? And then what happens to them at time two? So we're particularly interested here in the ways that intentions themselves may change, and also the ways that intentions may be vague or underspecified or unimportant, that fertility intentions might just not be that important to people compared to all the other intentions that they're trying to act on. So to do this, I'm going to be speaking today from data from the Kenyan Life Panel Survey, phases 1 and 2. This is, as I said, Ted McGill's project. It is a longitudinal design with two phases, and it builds on work that was done previously, a series of surveys that ended in 2001 that had a very important and completely fascinating experimental component that I'm not going to be using at all today, but I can tell you a brief bit about the experimental component if you're interested. That's the end. A lot of important things about this survey that make it so special. Very low loss to follow-up. This is kind of exceptional in poor countries. It's extremely difficult to follow people, even in rich countries, and particularly in poor countries. And since most of this work was done before cell phones were widely available in Kenya, it's even more amazing. But these give you numbers that are a good 10 to 20% higher than, for example, some of the Malawi project. And Ted and his group were able to do that because of this very elaborate and just kind of genius technique that they used for following people, following them wherever they went. So from Kenya into Uganda, to Tanzania, one respondent was interviewed in London, and really working very, very hard to follow people. The full sample is large. I'm here only using a very small subsample of 354 women who were interviewed with this much more intensive, what do you call those things? You add it to a survey?
Module.
on fertility intentions. But the full survey has extraordinarily rich information about education and household and work and all sorts of incredible things. A very nice set of cognitive measures that are in that survey. Kenya, if you don't remember, Kenya, New Zealand, East Africa, and the survey is done in the area around around Busia. So here's Kisumu, we're talking right here. So what is in this module? The module is a random subsample of women in the Kenyan Life Panel survey. We experimented originally with asking about these questions of men and women and found that most of the young men gave us answers like, I don't know. That question? I don't know. And so it just turned out there wasn't a lot of variation and it wasn't very interesting. And so we decided to only do this subsample for women. And what we have there is much richer marriage and fertility histories and also much richer sets of questions around future intentions and aspirations and desires and expectations. And particularly, we're interested here in exploring people's about different kinds of timelines for imagining the future and the degree of commitment that people have to these futures that they imagine for us. So we're asking questions like, including the however many you have now, how many children do you want to give birth to in your whole life? Do you think you might change your mind? If you couldn't, I know you said you wanted 4, but sometimes life doesn't give us what we want. If you can't have exactly 4, would you rather have 5 or 3? If this thing happens to you, if your husband takes a co-wife, would you still choose to have 4? Or would you rather have, in that case, have more or fewer? Would you like to have another child soon, later, or not at all? And do you expect to have another child within the next 2 years? And then if they say no, within the next 5 years. And for most of these, there's a forced choice part. You know, they have to say yes or no. And then if they say yes, and in some cases if they say no, then we ask them to please explain. And in most cases, the answers here are written out in Kiswahili, and I do not speak that. But the surveyors loosely translate. So the survey itself is very, very closely and tightly translated and back translated. These answers are translated on the fly. But just as a subsample, just to give you some sense of what people say, I'd like 4 children. Do you think you might change your mind? Yes. Why? Well, if I will experience some difficulty in taking care of the ones I already have, I might change my mind. Because the husband is the determining factor. If he doesn't want more, then I might not want more. If funds are available in plenty, I might choose a different number. If I am bewitched, or if my husband goes far from home, then yes, I plan to change my mind when I am old. Yes, and I should say, please do... I talk of Blue Street, but please do it interrupt me. You need to be more forceful than Ron.
Well, I noticed that there aren't any questions about, or responses about, if a child dies. You decided it would be people who take it as bad luck or something?
No, in our list of things, you'll see our list of things. We give them a list. If this happens, will you change your mind? If this happens, will you change your mind? If this happens, will you change your mind? And we do have child deaths in there. The answers that I just showed you were from a part of the survey before that. So we first ask, what do you want? Might you change your mind? If yes, free choice. Anything you want to tell us about why? And you're right. Child death appears, I can't say it appears never, but it appears very rarely. Not a common reason for people to say they want a different number. And then later in the survey, we give them this long list.
Yeah.
Can I ask another question?
Please, yes, yes.
Well, it's about whether they've already exceeded their fertility desires. Is there a chance for them to say, well, I've got five, but I wanted three?
Yes, there is, although these are young women. They're 17, most of them, they're all between 17 and 26.
Okay.
And most of them at the beginning are even, they're at the young end of that age. And so there are a couple of women who do answer, I want no more.
Mm-hmm.
But those, for the most part, those are women who have none.
Yeah.
And they appear, it appears to be one of those cases where the question we're asking and the question they're hearing are not quite the same question. Because they say, I want no more. How could I have children? I'm still in school.
Yeah.
And so I don't, because they're young, most of them have not yet achieved desired family size. Even the desired family size is actually quite small. Okay. So I'm not at all following what I planned to tell you. Okay. Okay, so now here we're gonna, this is just straight up description of the data. There, this is not controlled for anything. This is just straight distributions. And it's distributions from two questions in each of two surveys, KPLS 1 first phase, and then coming back 3 years later and asking questions of the same women. So on the left here, this is question worded identically in both surveys, including the however many you already have. How many children would you like to give birth to in your whole life? And then two sort of crazy experimental questions next to them. So the first thing to notice here is that the distribution of what people say they want shifts down a little bit. From 4 as the modal response to 3 as the modal response.
So those are the same people at two different waves?
These are the exact same people. And in fact, we've excluded here from, and this only includes in phase 1, the women who we actually found in phase 2. So these are exact same women.
How far apart?
3 years apart. So exact same women asked 3 years apart. So the mode moves down. And these fertility desires are a good bit lower than in the Kenyan DHS. The Kenyan DHS for women in this age group is about 3.8, so matches nicely in KPLS-1. By KPLS-2, they're giving us lower numbers. Another thing that's interesting to note here is that not only does the modal answer decline, but the concentration increases. So 38% gave us the modal answer, and 76% gave us an answer within one child of the mode. And in the second period, slightly more give us a modal answer, and again, slightly more within one child of the mode. So there seems to be not only a decline, but a concentration around, sort of clarity emerging around what is the right answer to this question. We also...
You have almost an identical number of people saying 2, 3, or 4 each time.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't...
That's fair.
My usual measure of concentration is with the mother mode. Right? You have very similar concentration.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, you've lost the 7, seven
well,
plus, and
you gained 1.
It's a little more concentrated. The total of 2, 3, and 4. You might measure the total of 2, 3, and 4.
We can move on. I just want to say that's not the only measure of concentration.
Absolutely agreed. Absolutely agreed. And we've got small numbers of people overall, and so, I hear you. So we also ask these questions about if we force you to change. If we force people to change, we get this nice-looking distribution.
I'm not going to say much more about it, but I want to talk about this one. This is the recalled desire of number of children 3 years ago. This is the close, so we asked them, imagine yourself 3 years ago, what number of children would you, do you think you would have wanted then? And the first important thing to note, and we're going to look at this in a moment in a more technical way, but the first thing to note is that this distribution looks really an awful lot like this distribution, and not very much like that distribution.
I'm assuming the question on the right is asked first in the survey.
The question on
the recall question is asked first before.
No, no, the desired number is asked first.
Oh.
But you haven't yet told them. Last time you told me that, and this time.
No, we didn't. We don't tell them.
What they say
they don't, we don't tell them, we came here 3 years ago and asked you this, and you told us four. Would you still say four? We say, imagine yourself 3 years ago. What answer would you have given to this question? And we do it that way because we're interested in this DHS question. If you could go back to the beginning of your reproductive life and have exactly the number of children that you would have wanted, what number would that be? Which we've known for years and years, everyone has been very clear that there's a lot of post hoc rationalization in that question. There's not a lot of post hoc rationalization here because these women, it's not like they've had their seven children and are retrospectively telling us that they want seven. We're just interested in can they remember what their past selves were like. And it looks like they do not do a very good job of remembering their own past selves.
I would just be concerned that asking them the desired number of children would bias their answer and their recall.
They're not right next to each other. My understanding, and please correct me, but my understanding is that most of the data about sequencing effects and whatever, they disappear pretty fast. And these are a good 10 minutes apart. Well, maybe 10 minutes, depending on how fast people talk. Four and a half minutes, if you're me.
And you've labeled it recall, but it's really counterfactual. Imagine yourself 3 years ago. So
yeah.
They've changed their minds, but think they haven't.
Their representation of their past selves is extremely continuous with their present selves. They envision their past as being very similar to their present.
You're doing this with the whole distribution, but the way I would normally do that is by doing it person by person.
Yep.
So the recall of what they were versus where they are now is recall, and
here it is.
So here what we're looking at is we're looking question by question, person by person, and we're looking what proportion of respondents are on the diagonal. That is, they give the same answer in the two cases, and then just what is the correlation coefficient? So two ways of measuring, I think, what David is asking for. And the point here is just that this nominally recalled desire, this imagine yourself in the past, is much less associated with their own pasts than is their present response does a very good job of predicting what they imagine their pasts were like. Okay, so the first thing here is this, in the DHS we've talked a lot about post hoc rationalization of people correcting their representations of their pasts to match their experience in between, people not wanting to report that son was unwanted. But it seems here that we also need to just think about people as, we need to think about people's cognitive capacity to recall or even correctly imagine their past selves, and that is also part of what is going on here. Related to the problem of remembering what you were like before is the problem of predicting what you will be like in the future. And of course, there's some lovely work in behavioral economics on people's predictions about their future desires.
And so one of the things we did is we asked whether respondents thought they might change their minds in the future about how many children they would want. Nearly 80% said no, 78.5% said no, I want four, and I do not, and I will not change my mind in the future. We let them change their minds, not at all. I can't remember if the wording is with difficulty or under certain circumstances, and then easily. I could easily change my mind. Almost no one could easily change their mind. So almost 80% said, no, I will not change my mind. And then later in the survey, we give them this long list of circumstances. If this happens to you, would you change your mind? If this happens to you, would you change your mind? If this happens to you, would you change your mind? Some of these things are not going to happen to most of them. And so so if they're sort of correctly predicting the probabilities of those things happening to them, then we shouldn't expect them to necessarily say that they will change their mind overall. But nonetheless, some of these things might very well happen to them. And some of them are quite common things. And so this difference is not a quite fair comparison, that 80% say they will not change their mind and only 20% remain consistent to that throughout our list. But it's nonetheless, it's sort of a provocative difference. So they don't expect to change their mind in the abstract, but in a slightly more concrete situation. These are still imagined future possible scenarios. This is still not terribly concrete. But even that little bit of concreteness dramatically changes how people answer. Now these are, here what we're looking at is the questions are just listed there. And do we have our... Yes, we have one of your children dies in infancy. So you've got your questions. Green is the proportion of people answering that they would still want the same number. Red is people who answer that under that scenario they would want more. And blue is people who answer that under that scenario they would want fewer.
So now, are these asked in order, or did you sort them?
These are sorted by, here they're sorted by the proportion answering they would want fewer.
Okay.
And I do not have here the sequence in which they were asked. that would have been very tight. We did such a good job of predicting our data. I don't have the sequence in which they were asked, and we didn't do anything like randomize it. I mean, the survey does not change the order. Everyone got them in the same order, and it was not this order. Okay, so first thing to take away, there's a lot of people who here indeed say that they will not change their number. And when they do say they're going to change, it's overwhelmingly that they will change to fewer. There's just an awful lot more blue here than red. And that is very interesting. There's a couple of cases where we have nicely matched questions where we're picturing similar scenarios. In one case, your situation improves, or your situation improves in one direction, and in the other case, in the opposite direction, clearly with the finances. We see that people's responses are very, very asymmetric. If people's finances improve, a small number say that they would want more, but not so many. If your finances worsen, there's a very strong tendency to want fewer. And we see this throughout, that co-wives, there's a great deal of conflict with co-wives in eastern Kenya compared to in West Africa, where in West Africa, many women select their own co-wife, and she's often a kinswoman, a cousin, or a relative. So that relationship is quite warm. In East Africa, co-wives are most often selected by the husband, even over the opposition of the wife. So the husband shows up with a co-wife and welcome to your new life. So a co-wife leaving is usually a very good thing. Women are very happy when co-wives go away for the most part. But here we see again that co-wife leaving is associated with a slight increase in the number of children a small number of women saying that they would want more, whereas the opposite, your husband taking a co-wife that you didn't know about, associated with a much larger proportion of women who will change. So, yes, please.
Do these distributions change by parity, and what's the average parity of these respondents?
It's under one at KPLS 1, and it's 2 and around 2 by the second one. Yeah, this is the other thing, is that when we wrote these questions, we wanted to write questions. Our original fantasy was to have common enough things and a large enough sample that some of these things might happen to some of these women. And we could see, you said that if a co-wife showed up, you'd change your mind, did you? And it turns out that 3 years and 350 women is just not enough. So that we have a few cases, but I'm talking about, at that point, individual women, and it's, yeah. Okay, so, second thing, sort of interesting point to think about is when, at least in this context, it appears that for the most part, when women are answering our questions about how many children would you like, they're answering the question, if life goes well for you, if things turn out the way you would hope, then how many children do you want? They're not answering the question, do a pretty good job of predicting the probabilities of your finances being good or bad, and given that assumption about how things will turn out, how many do you want? And now what I want to do is to look at what is associated with women's intentions in wave two, and with the number of births between waves one and two. That is, can we use information about desires and intentions and expectations as they're reported in the first phase to predict anything about what happens in wave two? So of course we're going to use regression for that, and I am emphatically not going to make causal claims here, but just try to look at some of these associations. In the data that I'm showing you, we're controlling for a gazillion things. I'm not sure that's a good idea. So I'd be curious about specific items, but I'd also be curious just about your general intuition about whether we should control for a zillion things. The sample is small. It works against finding measurable associations. That's what we're doing now. And we're going to first look at the stability or changes in desired numbers, and we're going to do this in two ways. We're going to just use OLS to look at the direction and magnitude of changes in this desired number of children, and then we're going to see if we can. Then we're going to try to predict who's on and who's off the diagonal. They are not paying any attention to which direction they're off the diagonal, just are you on or off? Okay. So when we look at being on the diagonal, we see that compared to a reference group of women who said that they wanted two or fewer children, women who want three specifically, that is women who give what turns out to be the normative answer, are the least likely to change. Women who report higher desired numbers are not measurably different from the reference category. Shorter-term measures, like expecting a child soon, are not associated with being on the diagonal. In the OLS, where we're predicting the direction and magnitude of change, if we tried both models both ways, this one fits better if we just use a single linear variable for the desired number of children, and that is the more children that you want, this doesn't mean that you're more likely to change, it means that if you change, you more reliably change downward. This is not surprising, it is precisely what Kesnov-Vallet and Morgan find for the US. It's probably what any rational human would have guessed we would find. But there are some results here that are a little bit interesting. Some of them are what we would expect, that when we force them to choose more or fewer, those who under forced choice choose more, when they switch up. Good. Some are a little bit puzzling. I don't know how to interpret this, that women who expected a child within 2 years, when they switch upward.
Some of those are maybe pregnant, or is pregnancy controlled?
It says, we ask about their pregnancy status, and the question says, including the children you have now, we ask if they're pregnant further on, including the two children you have now and your current pregnancy, how many children do you want to? So we intend to include the pregnancy. Whether they do, I don't know. We try.
Jenna, wouldn't it be people who are pregnant or already have kids who are selected for people who want to have kids? And therefore, they're already in the having kids mode, so if they're already doing that, they might want more kids.
Mm-hmm.
Those women who aren't having kids are the ones who actually don't want as many kids.
Yeah, it's when we look at the kids, when we look at actually what happens with births, it doesn't work as neatly as that, it turns out. Yeah, and like I said, we're controlling for everything in the universe. We're controlling for cattle. We're controlling for how many pregnancies have you had and how many live births have you had at wave one. So, but yes, I am not going to stand here and tell you that by controlling for stuff, I have dealt with selection. And that's why I'm not making any causal claims about this. That's one of the reasons. Okay. So when we look here at stuff that happens to them, did you get married? Did you end up staying in school through the whole duration? Did you have another birth between the two waves? For the likelihood that you are on the diagonal, none of that is measurably associated with being on the diagonal, although all the coefficients are negative, for what it's worth. Worth very little. Whereas if we're looking at magnitude and direction of change, getting married between the waves and getting married between the waves we would expect to be associated with an increase, probably. Being still in school, it's a little peculiar. It goes not the direction we would have anticipated. It does not go in the direction we anticipated. Cattle. We thought cattle would matter. Cattle don't matter. Okay, so now we're going to look at fertility outcomes. Between wave one and wave two, did you have a birth or another birth? And this is just any births, and that's because the number with two or more is very, very, very small. So we just put it with any or none. And we're modeling this in two different ways, or it's the same equation, just treating the desired number of children in two different ways, just as a linear variable, and then in these categories. Now, in both cases, we find a negative association between long-term intentions, how many do you want overall, and whether you progress to a birth or another birth. This is not because the ones who want lots are already in childbearing mode, and therefore maybe have just had a birth and so are in lactational amenorrhea or something, because we're controlling for that. We try both controlling for did you have a birth at all at wave one and also how long ago. So thinking about the duration of lactational amenorrhea. What it is extremely sensitive to is whether they married between waves. So here, both of these that I'm showing you, we're controlling for whether they married between waves. If we don't do that, the coefficients on all of these desired number of children variables switch. and they become significant, and they remain significant, but in the other direction. So this is, let me just finish this one thought, and then Margarita. So this is why what I'm saying, what is theoretically right to control for and not control for? This is where I'm sort of puzzling, because if we think about it imagining the life course of these people, then I can make a case either that we should or we shouldn't control for whether they marry, because their marrying is either, so Magali and then Claude. But you see my puzzle, I'm looking for help.
So the desired number of children in 1, 3, 4, 5 children, that's expressed at the first wave?
Yes,
or at the first wave. So, okay.
So this is all things that they expressed to us at time one, and this is all stuff that happened to them between time one and time two. Well, that they may have been very active agents, but that occurred between time one and time two. I'm not showing you any of the things that we control for of all the stuff that happened to them before time one. Whether they were still in school at time one, whether they had a birth at time one, whether they were married at time one, all of those things are also controlled, but I'm not showing you all of those. I'm sorry, Claude, yes?
So if I understand you correctly, the inclusion of the married variable flips the desired number of children variable. So obviously those two are highly collinear.
Yes.
So you can presume that a woman who wants children at time one is especially likely to get married immediately afterwards.
Right.
So it seems to me what you want to separate out is the marital, is the fertility issue from the marital issue.
Mm-hmm.
And a simple thing, it would be informative to just run the equations for married at both times, married at neither time.
Those who switch.
Yeah, those who switch it affected all that. But for women who are married at time one and married at time two, then you get a cleaner estimate of whether their desires are driving their births.
Great.
Similarly for those who are unmarried. And this is just one of the injuries caused by the nature of regression.
Yes,
multi-collinear.
Yes. And if someone, yes, thank you. That is extremely helpful. And I'm presenting to you as I am feeling ambivalence. So I'm grateful for any good advice. That's very helpful. Okay, we're almost done.
We're almost done, so we should let you have the next 5 minutes uninterrupted.
Well, I think
that's the best we can.
Okay, so here I've just told you all of this. I've told you that expecting another within 2 years is not measurably associated with whether you in fact have one. Within 2 years, although the coefficient is in the direction we would expect. This thing about whether you might change your mind, women who acknowledge that they might indeed change their mind are less likely to go on to have one in these 3 years. And then we've already talked about the special case of marriage. So the summary ideas I want you to leave you with is, there seems to be, acknowledging David's point, but there seems to be some increasing consensus about what is desirable. That consensus is a smaller number than in time one, and also a smaller number than would be suggested by the DHS. When women are answering these questions about the number of children that they would want, the number of children that they want, we should read these in this case as being assuming that life goes unrealistically well, assuming that co-wives don't show up, assuming that finances don't get worse, assuming that the harvest is good. And that's not the case everywhere. There's some nice data from East Germany that seems to suggest that this is not a universal, but in Kenya seems to be how women are answering this question. Then, from the highly dubious regression, intervening events intervening events seem to be associated with the direction of the change in ideals, but not in whether women change their ideals or not. The intentions, short and long-term intentions, are either not associated or negatively associated with births, and this is a little puzzling, and I think Claude's point about dealing with this question of marriage is the next thing to look at. And then of the intervening events, marriage is the story. It is the only thing that's associated with birth, with whether or not we give birth. So where do we go from here? For decades now, we've asked survey questions about desired family size without necessarily asking too much about the messy imagined futures in which women envision themselves marrying and rearing those children. So we've often treated fertility desires and fertility intentions in the abstract, as if they existed separate from people's imagined marital futures or other kinds. And I say that realizing that, of course, there's a rich sociology that doesn't do this, but if we read Bongartz or Boletow, I think that's a fair description. We could call this way of thinking the fallacy of the isolable parameter. So an erroneous idea that people have stable and independent intentions about something as socially embedded as reproduction. But reproductive action is very rarely abstract. Intimacy with this particular partner, the conveniences or disconveniences of this particular contraceptive method, the difficulty of getting maternity leave this year, many of the factors that are relevant to fertility behavior are overwhelmingly concrete and local and temporally specific. So when we think about that, and then I want to think jointly about that with these tentative findings about intentions, it's become very clear in studies of reproductive intentions that we get that long list of studies that I showed you. People get systematically better predictive power when they ask, what do you intend to do soon, rather than what do you want to do overall? But in these data, this does not appear to be true. The opposite appears to be true. There are differences in the proportion of women who bear a child. There are differences in the proportion of women who bear a child based on their two-year expectations and their soon expectations. I didn't show you those data. But those differences are much less dramatic than the differences between the bottom and the top of the desired parity distribution. So people reason from where they are. They misremember themselves as more similar to the present than they were in the past. They underestimate how likely they are to change if their life changes. So they reason from the present with some vague sense of the good and the right that orients their action, and that vague sense does have lasting consequences. So we should need to think about fertility desires as schematic and their enactment as conjunctural, that is, based in the present. Pascal, many years ago, made a distinction between la raison fine et la raison de géomètre, the reason of the geometer. We've too long assumed that reproductive actions are achieved by geometers. But I think that we can see, I think that this data leads us to suggest that the reason of reproductive actors is a raison d'être. Thank you.
Some fraction of people say they don't know their intention or uncertain about their intention. What happened? Are those folks in this analysis? Where are they?
We did a couple of things. First of all, we forced them to tell us. We did not accept "I don't know" as an answer to the question, "How many children do you want?" I expected that to be a huge problem. And it was a remarkably small problem. There were very few cases where our field interviewers reported having fights with women over this.
And also the soon question? Because you've invoked Phil Morgan.
I'm sorry, yes. So with the soon question, there we offered the options soon, later, I think we have not at all, although we don't make much sense of that, and I don't know.
Okay.
It's interesting, though. These women claim to know. So coming from Cameroon and Burkina Faso, I expected massive I don't knows. And we didn't get them. And I don't know if that is in part because these are, by definition, people who have been asked very lengthy surveys by economists and their colleagues for a decade. And they know
conditioned respondents.
And they know that they know very well that the survey goes a lot faster. give an answer. I don't know, but I expected a lot more I don't knows than we got, particularly also because the men kept saying they don't know. Maggie, I don't know the order. I'm sorry, Maggie and then Ken.
So two things I sort of follow up on what Mike was asking. The first is, did you have any way for the interviewers to record whether I don't know was their first answer? So, like, if you ask them and they say I don't know, and then you force them, first I don't know could still be really interesting.
That's great. I don't know, and I don't think so. It's not an exact
question.
Please tell us anyway.
No. because if I say yes, you'll ask why.
So I was also wondering whether in the other data, whether there's any information about intentions or expectations about other domains of their lives, and whether you could potentially look at fertility in the context of other, you know, expectations.
There,
it might be interesting to see whether they change more or less.
There is some. There are questions asked about what you expect whether you expect your income to increase or decrease in the next 12 months. But there's not a nice, rich, you know, Bean study of how likely it is that you're going to go to the market. Or, I mean, there's not anything like that.
Yeah.
But there are a few expectations questions about income. Mm-hmm. That would be nice. Ken, please.
So the picture you bring out in the real world is then complicated, and it would not be easy to use these data to then have the refined measure of action, relevant intention, without dozens and dozens of questions feeding into the scale. This is not the kind of research that goes to the improvement of knowledge, attitude, and practice surveys or something like this. Presumably, its wider relevance is to the ongoing big debate between demand-driven and supply-driven fertility change.
Mm-hmm.
And interested in intentions because they see that as the proximate variable to use if you think that fertility is demand driven.
Mm-hmm.
One way of reading your results would be that now that fertility transition has progressed to the point where we're talking about differences between 2, 3, and 4,
mm-hmm.
That we're out of the 7, 8, 9, 10 world, that fertility demand has become so contingent, so shapeable by events that will be highly random across settings, personal changes, and other things, that whatever is left to predict fertility change has got to be on the supply and access side. Are we reading too much into the long-term implication of what you're finding, or is this where you're going?
It's a very nice question. I think where well, first of all, I think that the debate between supply and demand driven is
makes a great deal of sense if you begin with first principles and reason to a debate, and makes a lot less sense if you start with an empirical description of people making fertility decisions and then try to reason back to whether it's driven by demand for children or supply of contraceptives. I just think it's a debate that has emerged in the literature because literature is like debates.
It's a fight over the allocation of resources.
And it's a fight over the allocation of resources. Yes. But that... I'm sorry?
You change hearts and medicine, Kathy.
Right. But that... Realistically, both hearts and medicine cabinets matter, and most of, with the exception of the occasional Lant Pritchett, most papers say there's a middle ground, and the middle ground is where the action is. I think of what this is being about is exploring what we mean when we talk about fertility intentions, and exploring. Just what do the things look like? What is their character? And if we begin with once we say, okay, well, we can't treat the relationship between intentions and actions as relatively mechanical, then we just need to think about, well, how can we treat them? And what... So I think the honest answer, Kent, is that I am neither capable nor willing to say much of anything that would be of use to anybody. that where I am comfortable is pretty far from policy. And I know that's totally dissatisfying, I apologize. Ron.
Basically, I'm a geometer.
You're my favorite geometer.
and I think this is a lot like deciding to open a window, which is also full of contingencies if we stop and think about all the things that could happen. I suspect that change from a mode of four to a mode of three. A mode of three is extremely important, and it's just over a three-year period. That's very quick. Of course, it's all very complicated. We mostly look for simplifying assumptions, simple stories we can tell, and I still think of the target fertility as... Yes, it changes over time. On the other hand, it seems to work out pretty well on average, and that's not inconsistent with your point that, for some people, income goes up, for others, it goes down, for some, their husband's nicer than they thought, for others, it's worse. All these things average out. And so a typical result, at least, used to be that, on an individual basis, these intentions don't predict outcomes very well, but on average, they do a very good job. So I would stick with that orientation myself. So I have some other questions, but that's the main.
The point that Ron is making that on the individual, that if we look at the aggregate, fertility intentions do a great job, for example, of predicting national fertility. So Lent Pritchett has that beautiful graph that you will all memorize that just shows. For all three measures, for wanted family size, desired family size, and ideal family size, and the TFR, in each case, you get this very nice correlation coefficient between aggregate intentions and aggregate outcomes. When you look at it within countries, it falls apart. So for Cameroon, if you do this, look at the association between the response to this question, if you could go back to the beginning of your reproductive life, and completed family size from 45 to 49, the R-square is 0.02, and the slope is flat. And Cameron...
0.02 is not so bad.
It's
And so, Cameroon is actually the most extreme case I've looked at in Africa. Although it is the center of the universe, on this particular parameter, it is an outlier. But in all the African countries, you get a substantively similar result, which is that within countries, there's very little association. And then the question is, well, what do we make of that? What I make of it is that the association that Pritchett gets is driven by the fact that African countries are different than other countries, and that countries in which a lot of women want lots of children are different in a whole variety of ways. They're structurally different. They're just different than countries in which women want few. And that if you ask people, how many do you want? You're getting some variant of, I look around, I see people who are happy and successful, and I ask myself, how many children do they have? And so stated fertility intentions are a really good Bayesian estimate of local fertility. And of course that's going to produce an aggregate association, but it's not driven by individual. It's the aggregate association that is driving, the association only exists at the aggregate, because it is people's estimates of the aggregate. And that it's, I just don't see any evidence that if at the individual level the association isn't there, then the aggregate association cannot be driven by individual intentions. I'm sorry, I don't know the order here. Yes.
Well, just following up on Ron, one way to test precisely whether or not there's this sort of intentionality is one of your nice answers was, women say that if they have only girls, they're more likely to have an additional birth, or if they have only boys, they're likely to have another birth, which is exactly what happens in the U.S. Angerton and Evans have a paper on this.
Even still?
Oh, absolutely. It's from the 2000 census. If you have two girls, you're more likely to have an additional birth if you have two boys, as opposed to one of each.
Right. So
you could look at
Morgan did, but he suggests that the effect is going away, right?
You could look in African data and see if the same thing is true. And since it lines up, that's a specific test within your framework that would line up with the sort of intentionality, and that'd be a kind of neat thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have an observation about your key question too, but I'll tell you later. Like I guess it along the line that you're talking about how mechanically you might get this coefficient.
Thank you. Yes.
So I think one explanation is this ecological correlation. That's another reason. But the major question is, another thing to think about your measure, your outcome measure, is this intention, which you I think justifiably both in your earlier work and here show this very fuzzy idea in the mind. So one thing to think about, or whether you thought about, is to think about it as it's a measurement error.
Mm-hmm.
Assume for a moment there is a real.
Right.
Or such a thing as a real intentionality. What's the measurement error? How would that affect things like regression to the mean, which is
mm-hmm.
one thing you could say that's happening, is regression to the mean.
Mm-hmm.
But the other is, perhaps, to think about the measurement error itself as subject to life experience. So that you're getting these women, you said very young,
mm-hmm.
you're asking them a very speculative question. 3 years later, they've had some experience,
mm-hmm.
they've observed the world.
Right.
Etc. And so there's still the nature of the measurement error itself may change. And I do think that there's something, so we've got a different measurement error pattern and size of time two and time one.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether that might affect some of the results.
I like it. I'm not quite sure what to do with it yet, but I really like it.
Maybe we can do one more question and then we can
stop. I apologize. I don't. I don't know who was first,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Please. So I was wondering, you said the fertility intentions are a reasonable Bayesian estimate of local fertility patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Did you include at all sort of the actual fertility patterns that were occurring? Because it seems like, was there a shift in fertility, and is that explaining these individual differences as well? Or are there really individual differences in life experiences that are changing the fertility?
So, within these data, the only fertility we can look at is the fertility of very young women. We're lucky in Kenya that there's DHSs. There's two.
And so we got nice estimates of fertility at the district level. And the district level, what you have is just totally flat. So Kenya is the example, actually, that Bongartz uses in his argument about stalled transition in Africa. That fertility is at 4 and is flat, and in some estimates might be rising very tiny bit. But it's not clear which is the, what is the right, yeah. So it's not, I think there's two separate things. I wouldn't necessarily predict people to be sensitive to changes in TFR over 3 years. What I'm saying about an estimate of, a sort of Bayesian estimate of fertility, I'm meaning why is Cameroon different from Niger, is different from Turkey? I don't think it's realistic to expect people to be that good at estimators.
Okay, thank you very much.